It really is an eye-opener, a homage to the planet and the universe. It's a wonderful thing. I'll see you tomorrow. Let me leave you with Stephen Crittenden with more wonder in the Religion Report.
Thanks, Peter. Welcome to the program. No, we're not doing homosexuality and polygamy in the Anglican Church this week. Everything that's happening now was predicted on the Religion Report back in February and March in our two-part series on homosexuality in the Church. And you can find the transcript of those programs on our website. But we are hard at work on a program on Jansenism, the Anglican Church, and the real potential for schism. And we hope to have that program for you in the next week or two. In the meantime, I'm told that half the Anglican bishops of Australia have tuned in this morning. And gentlemen, I can only say that we're eager to hear from you. Well, the word apostate refers to someone who renounces or abandons their faith, either to take up a new faith or return to an old one, or to become an atheist. In the earliest days of Christianity, apostasy was regarded as an unpardonable sin, and in many parts of the Islamic world, apostasy is still a capital offence. Well, Islamic apostasy is the new book by secularist Muslim author Ibn Waraq. It's the subject of his new book. You may remember when we interviewed Ibn Waraq a few weeks after the September 11 terrorist attack. He's the author of Why I Am Not a Muslim, one of the most forceful and least politically correct presentations on Islam you'll ever read. And the name Ibn Waraq is a pseudonym for obvious reasons. His new book is called Leaving Islam. It's part history of dissent and apostasy in Islam, and part collection of testimonials from former Muslims from all around the world, some writing anonymously, others willing to risk their lives by using their real names, and all writing about what it was about the Islamic faith that made them want to leave it. They include Muhammad bin Abdullah, who writes an extraordinary essay about how his movement away from Islam began with the nightmare of Bangladesh in 1971.
I saw a well-equipped invading army indiscriminately killing millions of civilians and raping 200,000 women. 8 million uprooted people walked barefoot to take refuge in a neighbouring country. The institution of Islamic leadership supported the invading army actively in capturing and killing freedom fighters and non-Muslims and raping women on a massive scale. Each of 4,000 mosques became the ideological powerhouses of the mass killers and mass rapists. And these killers and rapists, these Islamists, were the same people of the same land as the freedom fighters and raped women. That was the civilians of Bangladesh and the killer army of Pakistan in 1971. All the Muslim countries and communities of the world either stood idle or actively sided with the killers and rapists in the name of Islam. The message was clear. Something was very wrong, either with all the Islamic leaders or with Islam itself. I faced the truth of the mess of the Quran and Hadith. The Quran does not contain a single humane teaching that was not here before Islam. Mankind will not lose a single moral precept if Islam is not there tomorrow. After consulting the Quran, the Hadith, the Prophet's biography, and Islamic history for years with a guarded, open mind, I related the past to the present. People tried reforming Islam. It never worked. Again and again, Islam was mortgaged in the hands of killer leadership, while the rest of the Muslim world only said, "This is not real Islam." It is indeed dangerous to humankind that nothing can stop Islam from breeding cruel killers time and time again. That is because many of the Prophet's deeds and Quranic instruction are always alive there to act as fertile ground for breeding killers. Things happened in Palestine, Chechnya, Bosnia, Kashmir, Indonesia, Egypt, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. The catastrophe of September the 11th shook the whole world. I expected conflicting decisions of Islamic leadership in favour and against bin Laden based on geographic region. And how true my intuition was. Major Islamic leadership in North America and Europe Islamically denounced the cruelty of killing thousands by bin Laden. And the same leadership of the same Islam in Pakistan, England and Muslim-majority countries Islamically supported him as a hero. Once again, the dual character of Islam became clear. Islam has two sets of teeth like elephants. One is ivory, which makes it elegant and majestic. The other set of teeth is hidden inside its jaws and is used to chew and crush. All those sweet peace talks of Islam relate to the time and place of weak Islam in early years. But whenever and wherever Muslims were and are strong, they have another set of cruel laws and conduct. Tell me why the national flags of many Muslim countries have swords on them. A sword is not for shaving beards, it's only for killing.
The searing words of Muslim apostate Muhammad bin Abdullah from Bangladesh, writing in a new book, Leaving Islam, edited by Ibn Waraq. Now, I want to assure our listeners that we haven't included that extract in our program in order to be offensive to Muslims, rather to give a sense of just how incendiary this new book is. It's like plutonium. And what it is that some of these dissident writers in the Islamic world are risking their lives in order to say. And that's the point. In the West, if a Jesuit wrote a book detailing the shameful behaviour of German or Croatian Christians during the Second World War, there would be no death threats and no fatwas. Indeed, the author would find himself running from television interview to television interview. Well, earlier this week I spoke to a very tired-sounding Ibn Waraq in America and asked him about what had motivated Leaving Islam.
Well, I wanted to point out that there were a large number of ex-Muslims, and I wanted to hold them up as examples to other ex-Muslims to come out of the closet. I want people from Islamic countries to breathe a freer air because of the courage of these particular apostates. I wanted to open up a debate on Islam, and after all, freedom of conscience is a very basic human right which is denied many people in Islamic countries.
Is it meant for a Muslim readership?
It's meant for everyone, to show people who are dithering, those who are on the fence, those who are scared to speak out. One mustn't forget the climate of fear in which many Muslims, even in the West. May I read you a letter that was sent to the Observer in London at the time of the Rushdie affair? The writer from Pakistan wrote anonymously, stated that Salman Rushdie speaks for me. Mine is a voice that has not yet found expression in newspaper columns. It is the voice of those who are born Muslims but wish to recant in adulthood, yet are not permitted to on pain of death. Someone who does not live in an Islamic society cannot imagine the sanctions, both self-imposed and external, that militate against expressing religious disbelief. I don't believe in God is an impossible public utterance, even among family and friends. So we hold our tongues, those of us who doubt. And this climate of fear continues even into the West. There was a remarkable article in the Washington Times by Julia Duin on October 13, 2002, where she talks of something like 20,000 Muslims who convert to Christianity but who are absolutely terrified of revealing this to friends and neighbors. And she gives examples of those who do reveal it but who are then faced with ostracism, death threats, physical violence of various kinds. As far as I know, no one has been killed in the United States, for example, for their decision to leave Islam, but life is not particularly easy for them.
Well, it's a book of testimonials, many of them like the one you just read. But if the book lacks anything, it seems to me it lacks the kind of demographic information. I mean, we know that Islam often describes itself as the fastest growing religion in the world, but there's not much information about how much leakage there is. Is that because there is no such information? Is it because that information is very hard to come by? What's the story there?
Yes, indeed. For obvious reasons, those who do leave Islam, those who become apostates, keep it quiet. And the churches who baptize ex-Muslims are very reluctant to release the figures. They don't want to create a sensation and so on. But we do have, according to the figures in this article in the Washington Times, you do have at least 20,000 in the United States converting to Christianity. And then you have some figures that I do quote. People in Algeria, for example, in the Kabylie, converting to Christianity. One particular church recorded 50 baptisms in 1 year, which is quite remarkable. And it doesn't sound a lot, but in a country where you can have your throat cut just for wearing lipstick, this open avowal of apostasy is quite remarkable.
You also talk about apostasy in West Africa, in Nigeria, in India, and in Indonesia, where you quote the work of an Australian academic, Dr. Thomas Reuter of Melbourne University, who talks about, and I had no idea about this, mass conversion to Hinduism on the island of Java, tens of thousands leaving Islam for Hinduism in Indonesia over the past 20 years.
Yes, many of these Muslims who converted back to Hinduism, of course, were originally Hindus, so they were sort of going back, as it were, to their ancestral faith.
But it does seem like an enormous divide, cultural divide, to move from the absolute monotheism of Islam back to a religion of many gods like Hinduism.
Yes, indeed. But I suspect that their Islam, while they were nominally Muslim, must have been of a very syncretic sort of kind.
You're listening to The Religion Report with me, Stephen Crittenden. My guest is the, I guess, dissident former Muslim author, Ibn Waraq, the author of a new book called Leaving Islam, about apostasy all around the world in Islam. There is this history in Islam, isn't there, of killing apostates.
Yes, indeed. But of course, this varied throughout the centuries. I think I tried to make clear in the first part of my book, in the early history of apostasy in Islam, that the situation really varied from century to century, ruler to ruler, country to country. And there were some remarkably tolerant rulers. Others were incredibly intolerant. I give the example of the works of Al-Razi, who was a great physician, well known in the West as Razes in medieval Europe, or Razes in Chaucer, Geoffrey Chaucer's work. He was a deist. He was certainly very anti-Islamic. And yet he survived. He was not assassinated, which is a witness to the fact that he must have lived in a fairly tolerant culture and society. But unfortunately, of course, that wasn't true always. You had the period of the Inquisition, the Muslim Inquisition, the Minha, under Al-Mahdi, but that's the 8th century Christian era, or the common era, when many people were executed. There was a great intolerance in general of various kinds of Sufism, because Sufis were considered really beyond the pale.
Gnostics, even.
Indeed.
I mean, I can imagine many practicing Muslims, Ibn Waraq, who have no intention of leaving Islam, that they might actually find it interesting to read this book because it's a history of dissident Islam.
Yes, I hope that it does somehow add to, it might sound paradoxical, to the climate of tolerance, to show that Islamic culture wasn't always so monolithic and so on, that there were periods when people spoke up and defended their rights to question and to doubt. The poet Al-Mari or the poems of Omar Khayyam, one hopes that believing Muslims will also accept these free thinkers as part of their culture.
In the contemporary Islamic world, to what extent is the death penalty against apostates actually enforced, and where is it most enforced?
The most intolerant country at the moment is Iran, where people of the Baha'i faith are persecuted and accused of apostasy because they don't accept that Prophet Muhammad was the last of the prophets. They believe that their own Baha'u'llah was their last prophet. Since they do not accept one of the main tenets of Islam, they're considered apostates, and some have been executed. Sudan is another intolerant country where people have been executed for apostasy. The most famous, of course, was Mahmoud Taha. Egypt, on the whole, has been a bit more tolerant. There is the case recent years of Mr. Saladin Mohsen, who was accused of apostasy because he wrote a book criticizing Islam, saying that all the ills of Egypt came from Islam. He nonetheless, I mean, he was not executed, he nonetheless is still in prison for having insulted Islam.
There's a very interesting inconsistency right at the heart of Islam. One of the documents that you include in your book is a Shiite pronouncement on apostasy published in a Tehran newspaper in 1986 that actually deals with this inconsistency head on. And that is that the Quran says there is no compulsion in religion.
Yes, they tried to get around that by saying it really doesn't apply to apostasy. But Muslims have always been inconsistent on this issue. The right to change one's religion has always troubled Islamic countries. And when the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was being written, drafted and discussed in the 1940s, Saudi Arabia objected to this very clause, this Article 18 of the Universal Declaration about the right to change one's religion. And in subsequent UN declarations, many Islamic countries have been very uncomfortable with this clause about changing one's religion. Although, of course, they're totally inconsistent in that they are very happy when somebody converts to Islam.
And when Muslims leave Islam, why do they leave? A lot of the people who give testimonials in your book talk about reading the Quran being the thing that led them to leave, reading it seriously or reading it differently. There's somebody who talks about reading Maxim Rodinson's famous biography of the Prophet Muhammad. But what are the reasons?
There are all sorts of different reasons. I've tried to sort of compile a taxonomy of the reasons for leaving Islam, but as you just noted, one of the main reasons for many of them was that they read the Quran for the first time in translation. Of course, you must realize that the vast majority of Muslims are not Arabic speaking, and the Quran is written in rather difficult classical Arabic, and it's not even accessible to Muslims in Arabic countries, in fact, because of the difficulty of this classical language and the colloquial language. The language of everyday life is different.
That's very interesting, because in the Christian West, when the Bible began to be translated and to become widely available in the vernacular, you got the Reformation and you got an enormous upsurge of interest in religion and interest in Christianity. You got more fervour, not less. It seems that the opposite may be the case in Islam.
Well, yes and no. I think one of the paradoxical results of greater education. In fact, if you look at the composition of the various Islamic fundamentalist groups in modern times, you will see that the most tolerant Muslims are not the ones who are educated, but the uneducated people in the countryside, the rural poor who don't actually know precisely what is in the Quran, since they cannot read the difficult Arabic. Fundamentally, Islamic fundamentalism is a very much an urban phenomenon of people who are educated, who are able to read the Quran and take it very literally.
Ibn Warraq, W-A-R-R-A-Q, and his book Leaving Islam is published by Prometheus Books. You're listening to The Religion Report on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and the World Wide Web.